Hello and welcome to our insulin resistance practitioner training, coaching, and support call. I'm excited to be here with you tonight to share whatever words of wisdom I can with you, to coach you along in your progress through the program, and to support you in particular clients that you might have questions about. Or if you're working through for yourself at first, which a lot of folks do, and I highly recommend because it helps to really get a feel for the protocols on your own before you start recommending them to folks, then we'll be happy to help you with your own health issues or challenges or whatever you're having along the way. So these calls are set up to be led by you. I am your guide. I am going to give you answers, and I may pose additional questions. I'm going to give you resources, things that you can look up, and ways that you can better use what you're learning in the program to support your clients. So I would like to begin by just recommending that if you have questions and you want to chat on the phone, there's a star 2 on your telephone keypad, raises your hand, and I'll see it. We also have a bunch of folks that have typed in some questions in advance. So what I'm going to do is hit those questions first. I'll run through those. If you're on the phone as well as having submitted a question, then I'd suggest that you raise your hand if I need clarification. Because sometimes you will find this is true when you're working with clients, is that a question leads to another question, right? Or they want to know something and you need to know more. And that's the way a really good and thorough history taking goes. And it's really important that you develop that skill set. So I'm going to go into the Q&A where there was a whole bunch of questions that came in advance. One came in on the chat from Brooke, and Brooke said, it was on May 20th, so she typed this in a while ago. I may have answered this one already. Can we assume that insulin levels are low if your blood sugar drops and you get that shaky, lightheaded feeling? So I'm going to stop there and say, no, you can't assume that. What you can assume is that sugar is not getting to where it needs to go. So sugar may not be getting to the brain, and you're getting that lightheaded, shaky feeling. So it doesn't mean that the sugar itself is low in the blood. What I've found is that for some people, when they get that feeling, the sugar, when they test their blood, is actually high, but it's not getting into the cells the way it's supposed to. So if you're having that lightheaded, shaky feeling, it's not so much that you're going to necessarily see it low on the blood sugar. It's that the sugar is not making it in, which is as a result of, guess what, insulin resistance, all right? So Brooke says that she's had that feeling, like feeling out of sorts, lightheaded, but her blood sugar is actually in the 90s. And is it normal? Well, is it normal or is it common? There are two different questions. A lot of things that we see commonly in our patient population and in the population at large are actually not normal, but we think they're normal, right? We think it's normal to have constipation because there's all kinds of laxative commercials on TV, right? We think it's normal to have headaches a lot because of all the Excedrin commercials, but it's really not. It's just common, but it's common due to an imbalance. And anytime there's a symptom of not being right, there's something going on. So if you're feeling this out of sorts, lightheaded, it could be that the sugar is not getting into your cells regardless of what the level is. And so it, improving the insulin sensitivity, which is through all the things that we're going to be doing and doing it over the course of a month, can be very effective for that. I remember one person that I worked with, she had this feeling that she would get periodically, it wasn't every day, but she would get it periodically where she just felt that way, that out of sorts, that lightheaded, that spacey. And when she started checking her blood sugar, she was going along doing really well, and then she decided to try some raisins on her salad. The raisins on her salad shot her blood sugar up to 200, and she was shocked, first of all, because it was just a little bitty handful of raisins on top of a big salad, but that's where her body was at. But what she realized is that feeling that she always attributed to low blood sugar came back, and it was actually high blood sugar. All right, so Eric in Chelmsford, I don't know where Chelmsford is. So hi, Eric. What do you recommend for early morning awakening around 3:30 to 4 and trouble sleeping after that? Do you feel this is hypoglycemia, cortisol related? And if it was, would you adhere to no food 3 hours before bed and use the same supplements for insulin resistance? Thanks. Yeah, so this is an issue that a lot of people have, that awakening at 3:30 to 4, and it could be any number of things. It could be that their cortisol rhythm is off, in that the cortisol is supposed to start to come up very gradually between 4 and 8 in the morning, you know, given that range, depending on the person's exact time schedule, et cetera. But somewhere in that range, the cortisol starts to come up to its all-time, all-day high first thing in the morning. And so some people, because of a lot of reasons, it could be shift work, it could be being a college student and staying up late to study, it could be being a party animal, it could be being abused in the middle of the night. There's a lot of reasons. But some people actually, their cortisol rhythm gets shifted, and so they start to come up much earlier. That was happening to me once, and back when I tested my sugars, oh my gosh, my adrenals. My younger son, who just graduated high school, was probably 2 at the time, or maybe even 1. So it had been a lot of years in a row of disrupted sleep because of babies. And I was finding that I would just, even after, yeah, he must have been 3 because he had just started to sleep through the night. My kids did not sleep through the night until they were 3. So he just started to sleep through the night, and I was like so excited I got to sleep. I just kept waking up at 3:30 to 4 in the morning, kept waking up. And it was mainly because my body had gotten into that habit of waking up or stirring or, you know, listening for the kids. So some people are on that high alert, and it's really a matter of checking. You could run a complete cortisol panel or something called the Dutch test, which is, dried urine, testing for comprehensive hormones or something like that. But if you look it up, Dutch, you can do that, or you can do a cortisol rhythm test with the saliva. I'm starting to use the Dutch test a little bit more just because it's easier for the clients to do, and it gives me a lot more information. But either way, checking that rhythm, that adrenal rhythm, is a good thing to do. Now, you know, you'll be asking this person about history. You'd be asking him if there's a history of having been attacked in the middle of the night, having parents that used to fight and father came home drunk in the morning, anything where they're not feeling safe in going into that morning rhythm. So I would look at that. I would look at their sleep patterns and all that. However, here's the cool part. When you start to take people through these processes that we're giving you to help them to get a better night's sleep, to help them to reduce their stress, then you're going to see some improvement. And in answer to, would I still adhere to the no food 3 hours before bed? I would. I mean, you could certainly experiment to see if that helps and use it as an interim, but it's usually that food right before bed that causes a spike in the sugar, and then it drops during the night if they're waking up as a result of low blood sugar. So it could be the cortisol being high, like I said. It could be low blood sugar, which usually would be caused by eating high glycemic carbs too close to bedtime and causing a spike, and then the hypoglycemia that is reactive. It could be parasites. Sometimes people have parasites. And parasites do generally do their activity in the middle of the night. So there's any number. It could be, you know, if it's a mom who has been used to babies getting up and waking her up throughout the night. So there's a number of things that it could be. Now, there are some things that you can do if you determine that it is cortisol. You can have them do things before bedtime like phosphatidylserine or magnolia bark, which help to bring the cortisol down. You could do things like melatonin. It's possible their melatonin isn't high enough, and that could be a shortage of some nutrients. So there are some things you can play around with, but look at the sleep module. So we have a whole module on sleep, and see if there's some things that you can start to apply to help them get a better night's sleep. It's not necessarily going to be one thing or two things, and you just need to relentlessly go through the various combinations of things to try to help this person sleep. It could be a nutrient imbalance. It could be magnesium deficiency. It could be estrogen, testosterone imbalance, progesterone imbalance. So there's a lot of things that it could be. Okay? Dorte in Copenhagen, you're probably sleeping by the time I get to read this question. I'm in the process of taking a few clients through your awesome program. Yay! Thank you for inspirational insights to the spectrum of diabetes. Today's question, can one get addicted to daily glucose tracking? if you can call it an addiction, people get very curious and want to do it all the time and just want to see everything. I don't know that I would call it addiction, but certainly people can get to the point where they do want to test it all the time and they get a little bit overly curious, perhaps. Would it be advisable to take a day off in order to get in contact with your body and what it tells you and not following the numbers? If you feel called to do that, you certainly can. I think if people are getting obsessive about it, I would probably say obsessive rather than addicted, then, you know, maybe you have them take a day off, but follow the guidelines of what they've found over the days that they did test. So if you're going to take a day off testing and you've already determined that there's like this handful of foods that shoot your blood sugar up, you avoid those foods on those days. And while we're doing this testing, I guide people to do the testing during like an intro, you know, several weeks to a month period and determine how food's affecting them. But once they determine that there's a food or a group of foods together that will raise their sugar, you just want to stop eating it until you get through the metabolic reset, and then you go back and carefully reintroduce. So it's a good thing to get the information, but it's also allowing people to say, okay, every time you find one of these foods that shoots your sugar up, you want to take it off your list. Now, if they do a mixed meal, people ask this all the time, if they do a mixed meal, you know, they have salad and they have, you know, dates and they have beans or whatever, and the sugar goes up, you don't know which of those foods is going to be causing it. I would then retest with the most likely suspects, or there's two ways to do it, or retest with the least likely suspects, rule those out so you know, okay, if it was a lettuce, tomato, cucumber salad, with those other higher carb foods, then you just retest with just the lettuce, tomato, cucumber, and maybe you put, you know, olive oil or pine nuts on it. And you see if that raises the sugar. And if it doesn't, then you know it's probably either the dates or the beans or something else that was in that meal. And then you would test those foods individually. Or you could test them with some lettuce if you didn't want to risk too high an upping of the sugar. So there's a lot of ways you can do it, and you can make it your own. The more experience you get with it, the more comfortable you're going to be feeling with feeling out each individual person and their preferences and what they're willing to do. Great. You're welcome, Dorte. Next we have Brooke. Hey, Brooke. I have a ton of questions, she said. If you can't get to them all, I understand. They're all good questions. I read them all before, Brooke, so I will work it. Will the techniques for learning in an IRSPT work to reverse LADA diabetes or make improvements in somebody dealing with LADA? They will absolutely help to make improvements with LADA, but in addition, you're going to have to really address autoimmunity. And autoimmunity requires that you deal with their leaky gut and heavy metals if they have it, and improving their antioxidant status and a whole sort of other things. But these, the techniques we're teaching here, like the elimination diet and the antioxidant type of foods and the things that protect the cells and the essential fatty acids and the lower risk or lower foods that don't raise the blood sugar, all of that's going to help. All of that's going to help. But in addition, I think it's going to be important that you look at autoimmunity and reversing the autoimmunity. Does excess insulin cause problems in the blood vessels as well as excess blood sugar, or is it a blood sugar only? Great question, Brooke, and we do cover that. I don't remember which module we cover it in, probably even the initial module. But yes, insulin itself causes a stiffening of the blood vessels. So they lose their elasticity. So if there's like a surge of pumping of fluid or blood through the vessels, like because somebody's running or exerting themselves, there can be a lack of expansion appropriately of the blood vessels. And if there is a plaque in there, it's much more likely to get stuck and cause a heart attack. And that stiffening of the blood vessels can cause increased blood pressure. Yeah, so it's definitely both. The excess sugar causes the red blood cells to become glycosylated. So actually the sugar actually harms the cells themselves. And then the insulin harms the vessels, and that combination, it can be deadly, literally. I think that's what killed my mom and dad. What's the range for a bun to determine if they're absorbing protein? I usually like to feed the bun, which is blood urea nitrogen, and that's a blood test that you do. It's usually a test for kidney function. If it's high, it means that the kidney isn't adequately clearing the urea nitrogen. If it's low, it could be that you're not generating enough nitrogenous waste, meaning that you may not have enough protein or aren't digesting the protein well. I like to see it somewhere in the neighborhood of like, I'd say 13 to 16, 13 to 18, something like that. If it's below the 13, I start to suspect the protein. Can neuropathy be improved, pain be improved? The pain can be improved if the blood sugar come down and the damage is already set in. The pain can certainly be improved. It takes time for the damage to be reversed. Now, we don't ever know in anybody how far along things are and how irreversible something can be, but I'm of the belief that most things are going to be reversible, at least to an extent. So I've seen people with neuropathies improve once they improve their blood sugars, and they also, there's a lot of things that they can do to improve the circulation and help it to heal. So nutrients that help to heal. Capsaicin cream has been shown to be very helpful for the pain, which is made from like a cayenne pepper, a very strong extract from cayenne pepper, which opens up the circulation. And then neurotrophic kind of things, so things that would support the regrowth of nerves. But it does take time, so it's not going to be something that changes overnight. Depends on how long it's been there, how much damage has been done. But my experience is that we see a lot of improvement there. What is the body weight recommendation for chromium dosage? You know, I don't really have a specific one, but for an average adult, you know, in the neighborhood of like 120 to 160 pounds, the recommendations that I gave you are appropriate. For someone who weighs a lot more, maybe someone who weighs over 200 pounds, maybe you can add a little bit extra. For a little lightweight 100-pound, 90-pounder child, then you could adjust that accordingly, right? So assume that, if you assume that the dosage is appropriate for, say, a 150-pound person, if a person is below 110 pounds, maybe you want to adjust it down. If they're over, say, you know, 200 pounds, maybe you want to adjust it up. Is it okay to take chromium with a digestive enzyme before meals? I don't see any reason why not. I definitely like having people take chromium before meals. And nobody's ever asked about taking it with a digestive enzyme. The chromium is not, no, I don't see any problem, because if the chromium is a chelated form that's chelated with an amino acid, the digestive enzyme would just help it to get broken down. So I don't see any problem with that. Is there a way to measure insulin at home? Great question. There is, but it's not the same as measuring glucose. ZRT, Z as in zebra, R as in Rita Marie, and T as in Tom. Labs has a home kit, and it basically you take the blood, you put it on a little card, and then you send it back to them. So it's not the same as, you know, that instant gratification. It's also a little bit more expensive. It's probably $25 a test. It's probably around the same as what it costs to do insulin at the lab, but I like the home testing, the ZRT, and I do have that listed in the testing. It's on one of the slides in the testing module. But I like this, the fact that you can do it, because then you can easily do postprandial insulin. It's easy to go to the lab to get fasting insulin. But then if you want to eat, have your client eat, and then test after eating, it's a pain, right? They have to go out to their car, they have to eat, they have to come in, they have to make sure that they can get back in and tested within that 45-minute window. I mean, it takes a lot of coordination. So you might want to have somebody buy one of the kits to do the one at the postprandial, or I bought two kits and haven't tested it yet, but I wanted to do one in the morning, first thing on a fast, and then I wanted to go ahead and eat my typical breakfast and then go ahead and test it like if it's about the 45-minute mark. How do we test for thyroxin? Thyroxin is T4, and you can test for either free T4 or total T4 on a standard blood test. What are the benefits of Irish moss? Irish moss tends to have, it's high in carrageenan, which is kind of controversial right now, but I believe that carrageenan as part of the whole is fine. It's when you isolate carrageenan, it gets these flaky, these flakes that can absorb a lot of water and they can be damaging, but, you know, that's a controversial thing right now, just so you know. But I like to use Irish moss as a mucilage, so it's really good for coating and soothing and healing the gut lining. It's also been shown to be really helpful for the lungs. So people who have like lung cancers and lung irritation, it's known in Jamaica to be good for the libido in the Jamaican men. In particular, they don't mention the women, but it probably works for that too. So there's a lot of benefits to Irish moss. I also use it as a thickener to make like a pudding. So I soak it, turn it into a gel, and then add it to some fun stuff to make a pudding or cheese. Is there a relationship between bowel movement and low blood sugar? When my blood sugar has dropped before, I've had to go straight to the bathroom. Wow. I'm not sure what you mean by blood sugar. Like, when you say your blood sugar has dropped, do you mean like those symptoms you were talking about before, or you're actually your blood sugar has dropped? You know, there is a connection between the gut and blood sugar. There are hormones in the gut that control the release of insulin. And I, you know, I've not heard this before when somebody has a low blood, drop in their blood sugar that they had to go to the bathroom. But I'd love to know a little bit more and explore that with you to see why. Okay. We have a couple more. We have a couple more from, Brooke and then Luce and then Grace. And then I'll go to the phone to see. So raise your hands and I'll catch your hands. And if there's any, if for some reason you have a question and you're on the call and you need to leave at a certain time, type that into the chat so Lynn can let me know and we'll make sure that we get to you. But I only have a few more questions here and then we'll go through. So Brooke says, this is a good question. For somebody who eats blueberries and it raises their blood sugar higher than normal, is that actually a problem with blueberries or is it a clue that the cells are insulin resistant? Well, it's not a problem with the blueberries because actually blueberries are supposed to be helping with insulin sensitivity. They've been shown to be very helpful for that in a lot of people. So if someone is having trouble with blueberries, I think it's a sign of insulin resistance. Because if the cells weren't insulin resistant, wouldn't the insulin be able to clean up the, yes, the blood in the timely manner? Or is it just that blueberries raise the blood sugar so fast? No, it's not that at all. Blueberries actually raise the blood sugar much more slowly. They're considered one of the lower glycemic fruits, and they actually have things in them to help sensitivity. So if someone is having trouble with blueberries, they're probably pretty severely insulin resistant. And that happens. I see that a lot when people start the process. They're doing the testing. They find they do the blueberries. They stay off of the blueberries and the other fruit for the 30-day metabolic reset. And at the end, they can add them back in. Sometimes it's the way you eat blueberries. So if you eat blueberries by themselves, it may cause the sugar to go up. But if you eat the blueberries along with, say, some lettuce or celery to slow it down and have that fiber slow the absorption down, then that could be helpful too. So for each of your clients, your goal is to help them to come up with their own insulin resistance reversal diet, which might be different from client to client. So Luce from Delhi, we have a lot of international students on this program. It's really exciting. I have a client who's a 54-year-old Hispanic woman, diabetic for 6 years. Current medication is metformin, 1,000 milligrams twice a day, glipizide, 10 milligrams twice a day, Lantus, 100 UL per milliliter twice a day, among other prescribed medications. So she's on lisinopril, I think that's a blood pressure, 5 milligrams, simvastatin, I think that might be like a one of the statins, 10 milligrams, Cyclopram 20 and naproxen. So she's got pain, she's got inflammation, she's got some cardiac stuff, and she's also on gabapentin 300. So she's probably got some depression or anxiety or something like that. So just from her medications, I'm seeing that she's suffering from probably a lot of toxicity, probably a lot of liver stress. They're not able to get her blood sugars down even on all that medication. And she's got also already a lot of complications. So she came in to see Luce 3 weeks ago because an MD hasn't been able to help her with the sharp pain that starts in the prefrontal cortex and goes into her eyes. The right eye is losing sight. She has to wear sunglasses with minimal pressure and pain. It gets worse with bright light. Symptoms started 3 months ago. Other symptoms she's experienced are sciatic pain, hot flashes, burning feeling in her feet. I have her on your nutrition protocol, supplements, magnesium, omegas, B-complex, berberine, Chinese herbs that help the pancreas. In 3 weeks, she hasn't had much improvement. Fasting glucose when starting was 190 to 210, hasn't gone down. So that's really, really high for someone who's on all that medication. Pain and pressure in her eyes about the same. The only improvement is just diminished hot flashes. Could insulin or any of the other medications she be taking? Is she taking insulin too? I don't see insulin there. She's taken be causing her symptoms. Yes, hopefully you can help me, give me recommendations. New student doing your program at a slow pace because I don't speak English fluently. I understand your questions perfectly, Liz. Very fine. Yeah, so this is a complicated case. And so we really want to get a thorough history. right? So when you say she's on the nutritional protocol, is she on the foods? Has she lowered her foods down? Is she only eating the foods that keep her blood sugar, you know, like at least at fasting? With somebody who doesn't, who has a high blood sugar like that, you can't use the keep them down to under 110. So what I would say is if her fasting blood sugar is between 190 and 210, then you want to make sure that she doesn't eat foods that make it go up any more than 10 to 20 points. And so that could be really restrictive, and that can help to jumpstart it. But of course, what I first start to think about when someone's on that much medication, and she's also that young, 54 is not exactly old, I'm starting to suspect that, you know, maybe you need to definitely check her insulin, her fasting insulin and her postprandial if you can, but minimally her fasting insulin to see what she's producing, to see if this has gone beyond type 2 diabetes and has either never been type 2 diabetes and has been LADA, latent autoimmune diabetes of adults, or if it's type 2 that's progressed far enough that her pancreas has gone into failure. Given that she has been only diagnosed as diabetic for 6 years, we don't know how long that's been going on before that. But given it's a short-term diagnosis, it's less likely that it's the pancreas is worn out and more likely that it's a LADA unless she's been in that situation for a very long time. So then it was just diagnosed 6 years ago. So I would be looking at her fasting insulin to see where that is. We want to know what we're dealing with here, right? Are you dealing with a standard type 2 diabetic, or is this have either pancreatic failure or LADA? So I would start with the fasting insulin. If that shows up to be good, I would probably also go with a postprandial insulin, because you want to see if the postprandial insulin, like say the fasting insulin is a 3, and then you do postprandial insulin like 45 minutes after she eats a meal with some carbohydrate in it, and her insulin only goes up to 4 or it stays at 3, we know there's probably pancreatic insufficiency happening here, right? Versus if she goes up to 200 or 30 or 15 even, we know that it's not pancreatic insufficiency and it's likely still insulin resistance. So we're going to treat it differently depending. Now, the pain in the eye, of course, I don't know each and every one of those medications, but what you can do is go online to drugs.com and look up each of those medications to see if the eye pain and headache in the frontal area can be related to any one of those medications or an interaction between the medications. It's a lot of medication that she's on, and any number of them could be creating those problems. If it just started 3 months ago, I'd also be looking at what changed in her diet, in her lifestyle, and her exposures in her medication regime at about that 3 months ago or a little bit before that 3 months. So you really want to get at what is going on here, like what's the set of symptoms, the set of circumstances that's led to where she is right now. And you want to nip it in the bud pretty quickly. So, and again, you've got her on some good stuff. I would be looking at the diet. I would be looking at her monitoring her blood glucose more regularly. And you might even, if she's open to it, consider a water fast, because that's one of the quickest ways to help bring things down into a good range. You can do it even a 3-day water fast. Do it again, like 10 days later, do another 3-day water fast, but that can be very, very effective. But again, you've got to be careful because she's on medications and it may be contraindicated there. Okay. So that's, and then if the sugars go up or don't go down as a result of that, then that's telling us there's a different situation than just insulin resistance going on. So good luck with this one, and please do keep us posted on it. I want to hear what you find out. Grace has a 50-year-old divorced man in Indiana with diabetes and hypertension, helping because he can't sleep at night. He wakes up a bunch of times, and even though college educated and trained as a bodybuilder in college, he's had somewhat of a rough life. We're working on his diabetes and stress. In doing a history, I found that when he was 16, he had to leave home. Can't remember where he was staying, but he woke up with someone holding a knife over to his throat. Can't help but think this is affecting him still. Needless to say, he's a very light sleeper, recovering alcoholic, seems to live off his emotions, and lives in a lot of drama that he creates. All that being said, he's doing what he needs to reverse his diabetes. My question Is there some way for him to deal with his childhood trauma without sending him to ineffective counseling? I know that EMDR is very effective, but what would you suggest? Yeah, so you're right on to think that that trauma in the middle of the night that happened to him makes him feel unsafe while he's sleeping, causes his cortisol levels to keep him at that alert state. So that needs to be dealt with. EMDR can be very helpful. There's a trauma therapies that can be very helpful. There's people who do energetic work like that. I have a friend in California, no, she's in Austin now, that does some energetic stuff on old past traumas. She's got a thing called the Lionheart Institute out in California, but she does remote sessions with people. I have another friend who's trained in trauma healing. She is dealing with those kind of traumas and retraining the body. I think that counseling doesn't necessarily do it, but I think specific techniques, tapping is another thing, and really having them learn to do the heart math. I think that you're onto something that's related. And also looking at it as adrenals. I would see if he's open to running an adrenal test, see where his numbers are, and start to support those adrenals from a physiologic standpoint. What happens with that kind of stress, you know, the adrenals are on hyperdrive, it's just depleting his vitamin C, which is going to have cause problems in all other areas of his body, right? So those are some of the things that I would look at, Grace. Okay, I'm going to refresh, and then I'm going to go see who's got their lines up, their hands up. Here we have Jones Mill, Arkansas. Hi there.
Is that me, maybe? Brooke?
I guess it is. Who are you?
This is Brooke.
Oh, hi, Brooke. Oh, Brooke. Why do you show up in Arkansas? Aren't you in Hong Kong?
I'm in Arkansas.
Oh, I was thinking of somebody else that's in Hong Kong. Okay, cool. Somebody else is in Hong Kong. I think it's somebody else named Brooke. Maybe it's a different name.
Wow.
Okay, yeah. Great. So, yeah, you had some great questions there.
Thank you. My mind is on overdrive, and my hand's so tired from riding. I'm glad to have a break and talk for a minute. Okay, so I just had a couple of questions that came up when you were answering some of my questions. And the first one, the very first question that I had asked when we were talking about if you get that shaky feeling and you feel like your blood sugar is low, but it's actually not. I know it's a scary, scary feeling. So what would you suggest to do to help that feeling out? I mean, it doesn't happen very often to me, but when it has happened, I've had to, you know, drink a soda or eat something that I feel like brings my sugar up. It relaxes that feeling. So what should I do instead?
Okay. Yes, that's a great question. So if you don't do anything, it lasts for a long time. Is that it?
Yeah. Well,
okay.
I can't really say a long time because, you know, I start panicking.
Got it. Do you drink? Do you just like try to drink water when that happens?
I haven't tried that. And it's been a little while since that actually happened to me. It hasn't happened in a while, but.
Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of things I could recommend that you do. If it's that you've got plenty of sugar in your blood, it's not that you don't have enough sugar in your blood, it's that the cells aren't picking it up. So anything that we know of that helps to improve insulin sensitivity can help. So for example, taking some chromium. For some people, eating some chia seeds or a little bit of avocado because they help improve the sensitivity, taking some berberine or any of the other supplements that we've recommended might help. For some people, doing some heart math, like just okay, as long as you're not driving when it happens, if you can just lay yourself down, calm yourself down, you know, hold on to your heart, do some breathing, that can sometimes bring it down. Okay, but if you're instead of reaching for a soda, if you really feel like that's the only thing, these other things aren't working, and that having something, taking in some calories, I would go for something, I would go for the healthiest thing I can think of that might help, like blueberries, right, where there's some sugar there So it can raise your blood sugar, but it's also got some really good properties. It's got antioxidants and all that. Whereas the soda is just pure crap, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, I don't want, that's the last thing I want to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially
yeah,
so if I'm myself, I get so afraid.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, and even sometimes an something that's not, you know, maybe counterintuitive, but I've had people get help with that, is like, you know, a handful of almonds or sunflower seeds or something like that can sometimes help. So I would play with different kinds of things, but I would start with really telling yourself, you know, you're not going to die. Everything's okay. Breathe through it. Do some heart meds, do some tapping, whatever kind of techniques you like to do for stress management, and then see how that goes. And if you're still feeling, and then make sure you drink. Because sometimes hydration can do it, lack of hydration. So drink plenty of water. And then if you need to reach for food, then reach for some blueberries or almonds or coconut or something like that, or chia seeds.
Okay. 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 I can do that. And one more question. The question about the blueberries, you know, was it the blueberries that was the problem, or was it the cells being insulin resistant that was the problem?
Yeah.
I probably shouldn't have used blueberries there, but it was the first thing that I could think of. I was mainly thinking of, I mean, we could even say quinoa or chips or something of that nature, that's not necessarily a low glycemic food. Is it more of the food's fault or more of the...
No, it's the body. No, it's the body. Okay. A good, healthy body that's totally in balance should be able to sit down and eat a bowl of pure sugar. And not have their sugars go out of balance. It goes up, the insulin takes care of it, it goes in the cells, right? I'm not suggesting that, because over time, if you keep doing that, then the cells do become insulin resistant. But somebody that's perfectly balanced and healthy, they've done this with glucose tolerance tests, and I showed the graphs in one of the videos, and they've actually tested people where they give them that sickly syrupy sugar stuff that they do when they do glucose tolerance tests. And a good bunch of people in the lower end, their sugars barely went above 100 and then came right back down. Those are people who are balanced. They don't have insulin resistance. So it's not the food. Now, the foods are the culprit if over time you just keep eating these high glycemic foods and it's aggravating. The food might have caused the insulin resistance to begin with. But in a perfectly good body without insulin resistance. I had somebody say to me they wanted to check out to see if bananas were okay for their blood sugar. So they made a smoothie with like 8 bananas and a handful of kale. Now, I don't even think I could drink something that sweet, but they did. And they said their sugar only went up to 96. But that same person ate one corn chip and the sugar went up in the 140s.
Okay.
It's just a matter of what is it for that person. Now, did that person have a problem? Maybe she did, but, I don't know. Those are situations where one food does it and another doesn't that are kind of baffling, right? But, and it may have been that the corn she had an allergy to. And in that case, maybe it was the corn, or maybe it was her body's reaction to the corn itself.
So eating a food that you're sensitive to,
because what happens when you eat a food you're sensitive to, it can cause a stress response in your body, which can cause your body to start to secrete cortisol. And when you secrete cortisol, you start to release the stored proteins into sugars, and it'll cause your blood sugar to go up.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Good questions. And just to know, all of the stuff's covered in the module, so you'll have a head start when you get there.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. All right, we have Grace. Hi, Grace.
Hi, Dr. Rita Marie. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So I wanted to ask another question about this man that I'm helping. And one of his difficulties is that when he gets to evening, he's starving to death. And I said, well, you know, the guy's like 6'4". And he's only eating a power bar in the morning and something else. I don't remember what it was. And I said, you know, you're setting yourself up for cravings because your body's screaming for nutrients.
Yeah.
So I got him to do a smoothie in the morning. But it seems like he needs something else. He's not vegetarian, but he's doing lean meats. And not eating before bed, you know, the principles that we've gone over, he's doing them. And his sugar, he wasn't real high. He was like 150s. and he's on metformin, so he wants to get off. And mm-hmm. so is there something else that he can do to get more protein?
Sure, just a smoothie isn't going to do it for a guy that's 6 foot tall and has a high need, right? And you said he used to be an athlete, so he's got a lot of lean muscle mass on his body, so he has to support that. I would say, you know, get him to have a more substantial breakfast. Get him to have, you know, a smoothie with maybe, if he wants to do a piece of fish or something like that, since he's not vegetarian, or he can do like a chia porridge, or he can do, what else? Some, you know, coconut or cashew yogurt, which would give them some more fat calories, protein calories, and calories to make it through the day. And then make sure that he goes, you know, waits like 4 hours and then eats a nice lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Not just a salad, not just some vegetables, but have some fat and protein with that.
Okay. He is, he's actually not real lean right now. He's like 300 pounds.
Oh. Yeah.
And so he got in trouble because he's been on high blood pressure medicine since about 2002 and metformin since 2008. And he stopped, he only stopped drinking 2 years ago. So, I've taught him heart math. He says it works and
Great.
He's doing it. And he started to exercise. What I really want to get him to do is to do the burst training and not get on the bicycle for an hour.
Mm-hmm. Well, he can do both, but maybe not a full hour. It depends on where his adrenals are at too, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So doing bicycle for maybe a half an hour every other day, or walking. In addition
okay.
to the burst, and the burst will be good to build the strength, but, and to lower the blood sugar. But I think that there's no reason not to, unless he's completely adrenally burned out, in which case get him to do walking or very, very slow, moderate, no more than a half an hour on the
okay.
bike.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, he actually is walking. He has some kind of a river park that he can go to and walk, and he loves to do that. So
great. That's perfect, because then he's outdoors. He's got the fresh air. He's got sunshine. He's got, you know, a lot of good benefits to doing that. But I think that just if you just get him to follow some specific meal plans and make sure that he's eating the lower glycemic foods, is he willing to test?
Yes.
Okay.
He got a glucometer. And
great.
I taught him how to test for food so that he can see. One day he went to Taco Bell and he had one of their, I forget what they call it, but they have some kind of a lean meal that you can get there, Fresco or something meal. Anyway, his blood sugar shot up to like 190.
Yeah,
and,
well,
and
lean means high carb generally,
yeah.
right? That's like,
yeah.
that's just a synonym. A lean, low fat meal means it's high carb. What else
yeah.
can it be, right?
yeah. So anyway, I said, well, it's probably the corn, because he had some kind of lean meat. I don't remember what he had now in my notes. I have it, but so he's not doing that anymore. He's kind of abandoned Taco Bell, which I said was good.
Good.
And I had him buy a shaker jar so that when he's on the road, because he travels, he's a salesman, he can have his protein shakes and have that with him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
but
if he's willing to put green powder into the protein shakes, it's going to fortify the protein, but also give him a lot more nutrients.
Okay, so he got some green powder. It was called Amazing Meal, and he wrote
yep.
me an email, and he said, yuck.
Oh, yuck. Yes, some of them are yuck. For people who are sensitive, there's a few that do taste good. Amazing Meal has a lot in it, and it is yuck, actually. I mean, and I'm pretty tolerant, right? I drink my straight kale smoothie, and I don't think that's yuck, but Amazing Meal is not so good. But there's one from Health Force that's got mint in it. It's a green protein mint thing. That's
okay.
very good. It's got a lot of the greens in it. There's, what's that called? Greens First. It was one of the ones that came out years ago, but the reason that people love it is because it tastes good. It's got mint and stevia in it, so go figure. I think that Sun Warrior Ormus Greens tastes pretty good if he likes mint. So there's a number of them, and I would suggest go to Whole Foods or whatever store is nearby and just pick up some of the little sample packs. So don't buy a whole pack. Don't buy a whole thing of it. Just buy a whole bunch of sample packs and test them out.
Okay. That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and even simple things like there's Z Natural Foods carries dehydrated kale powder and dehydrated broccoli sprout powder. And believe it or not, they both are very mild tasting. So if you were to mix that up with the protein drink and maybe put a little, you know, cinnamon, that'll help his blood sugar, and, you know, some mint or whatever else he likes. That's a really good one too. Chai. People love that chai flavor, chai seasoning in there. So there's a lot of ways he could do it and make it taste good. But I was shocked at how good the kale. I was like, okay, how's this going to taste? I was shocked at how good it tasted. Same thing with the broccoli sprouts.
Okay. One more question.
Uh-huh.
As far as protein, like, I think he's trying to cut down because, you know, a lot of the sites say, you know, your protein should be the size of your fist and all that kind of thing. You have a thought about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that people are over protein. They're eating too much protein, and with it comes all the downsides of too much protein and too much animal fat and all that. So, yeah, he's 6 foot. It depends on how much lean he has, but you know, really, somebody asked this before. I don't remember if it was on this call or it was in a different group. It was on the IRSPT group. Someone asked about someone that she was watching a video or something, and they said people should be having a gram of protein for every pound of body weight. She wanted to know my opinion about that, and I said, that's horrendous. That's ridiculously high. They should be basing their protein on their lean body mass. So the ranges that I've seen quoted are between 0.6 and 0.8 grams of protein per pound of lean mass. So if somebody weighs 300 pounds, likely they don't have 250 pounds of lean muscle mass, right? They're more likely to have 150 pounds of extra fat or 100 pounds of extra fat. Well, he's 6 foot, so he probably should weigh about, you know, probably 210 or 220-ish. So he's got about 80 extra pounds. Those 80 pounds are likely to be extra fat. So his lean mass might be, 180. Right? And then so it would be 180 times 0.6 because he's not athletic right now anymore. 0.8 would be for athletic. So he really doesn't need a lot of protein. What you want to make sure is that he is, you know, getting a decent amount and that he's digesting it. So making sure that he's following the breathe and appreciate before meals, and he's chewing and maybe taking some digestive enzymes and making sure that his HCL is good. So there's all kinds of things like that to make sure that what protein he gets in. And if he's supplementing with the protein powder, especially because he travels a lot, I would suggest that he does keep the protein down because, listen, right, he's going to be traveling. He's not eating at home and buying organic grass-fed meat. He's going to restaurants, which has probably lower quality meat, and you don't want him to be getting much of that, if any. I recommend people are vegetarian when they go out. If you want to not be vegetarian, you do it at home when you can control what you get. But if you're going out, most likely the meat is of low quality, so don't do it. That's how I feel about it.
What about, I know I talked to him about allergens and things to stay away from in the beginning. You know, we went through what he could have, and then we went to the things that he couldn't have. I wondered about eggs. I told him, if you're going to do eggs, grass-fed, vegetarian, organic. And
right,
so,
fertile.
Right.
I would say that's on the top six list, right? So I would make sure, this is what I like to do for everybody, at least during the metabolic reset, if not as they're leading into it, go the 30 days off of those allergens. And then you can introduce them one at a time and see how he feels. Because it's not necessarily that you get a tummy ache or a headache or any other sensations that are obvious. It could just be causing an overall malaise. Right? And then they stop eating it, and suddenly they feel good, and then they sit down and have scrambled eggs for breakfast, and they just feel a little off. I would do that. Keep them off all those allergens for 30 days.
Okay.
And then have them retest.
Okay. Is there anything that he can use for sleep while he's getting his trauma work done?
Yeah, so if it is related to the adrenals, then there are this something called cortisol manager, which is a combination formula that has phosphatidylserine and magnolia. He can get individual supplements of phosphatidylserine or magnolia, supporting the adrenals in vitamin C and the B vitamins and zinc and things that the adrenals need. Mm-hmm. And then adaptogens. If it's low melatonin, then looking at some of the supplements, and the sleep module has all those supplements listed out, but looking at maybe 5-HTP and vitamin B6 at bedtime, that might help increase melatonin, or even just try melatonin.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause, right, you're looking to get to the root cause, but while you're looking to get to the root cause, you want to give somebody some symptom relief. So just I would experiment with some of the stuff we have in the sleep module to help him, you know, make sure that he's not watching TV right up to bedtime, not using the computer right up to bedtime. Most people take their cell phones to bed with them and are sitting there texting and Facebooking right until they go to sleep and turn it off, and that causes the pineal gland to stay stimulated, which means that it's not going to produce melatonin.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense?
I know that one.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and we'll get him going on this.
Yeah, good luck. It sounds like he's cooperative, he's wanting to do this, and it's just a matter of moving at a pace that he's going to be able to tolerate.
Right. Okay, Rita, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.
All right. So I'm going to go back to the Q&A. If you have anybody else has questions, star 2 on your telephone keypad raises it. We have Kay from Sydney. Boy, we have such an international crowd tonight. Often you talk about stats like blood glucose or insulin levels in the modules. The units are not always mentioned. I've only just finished the overview, so maybe this covered later. Where can I clarify the units for each test? Oh, great question. I think they differ from in your units to my units, and the numbers differ, right? Okay, so if we're looking at glucose, yours is moles per liter, and ours might be milligrams per deciliter. So the way that you convert, I'm going to look this up. There's a conversion chart, and I give it to you for glucose in the report, like in the assessments module. So that's module 2 or 3. I think it's 2. So let me just look for SI. So you'd want to be looking up SI, which is Standard International, and then 2 US units conversion. Okay. Ooh, here's one. There's a bunch of them. Oh, here's a calculator, and then there's a chart. So I'm going to give you the links to both. I'll put them into the, let's see. Oh, these aren't, yeah, no, this isn't, that's not the right one. We're talking for, there are some conventional to SIU global, here we go. This might help. Okay, so this is for, see if it has glucose. Glucose, it has cortisol, it has ferritin. Yeah, this is a good one. And it gives you the conversion factor that you have to use. So if you're converting from the conventional units to the Standard International, so ours would be considered the conventional, what I usually give, to Standard International, you're going to be going multiplying by the conversion factor. And if you're going from Standard International to the conventional, you're going to be dividing. So I'm going to put this into the chat. And we also have this on not this particular page, but we have a page that we reference back in module 2. Let's see, she said. Oh, yeah, so you just finished the overview. So in module 2, which is the assessments, there are some charts and there are some conversions, but we'll give you a head start on that by putting this into the chat. Oh, they knocked me out of the chat. Okay. And Lynn looks like she might have put one up too, so there's a couple of them. Okay. Oh, no, she found the same one as I did. Lynn, you're quicker than I. Okay. Diabetes Australia Org advocates the following for blood sugar. Do you agree? 4 to 6 before meals, 4 to 8 after meals, ideal 4 to 6 before meals. I'd have to convert that. So I don't know what those mean in our units, and they're probably high is my guess. Up to 11 after meals, that's a whole bunch of hooey. That means you're screwy. You're screwed up. Ideal 4 to 6. I think 5 is somewhere in the 90s. Lynn, can you run these numbers? I'm going to put these in the chat. And if you can run these through the converter and see what they come up to be. You know, they say up to 8 after meals. Now, 8 is probably like 140. So there, I don't agree with them. I can tell you right now, I don't agree with them. But if we can convert them, our numbers to your numbers using the conversion, you can convert 110. What does that mean? You convert, 85. What does that mean? So I'm going to put this into the chat and let's see if we can do the conversion. So you basically use those conversion units. So if we look at, glucose, the number is, the conversion factor is 0.0555. So we're going to multiply, we're going to divide your number by 0.0555. So if you were to divide 11, let me find my phone so I can use my it's not here. I was going to use my phone to use my calculator. I hear this. So if we take the 11 or the 8, which they say is the high, is a range after eating, let's see what that comes out to be. And you're going to divide it by 0.0555. So calculator. Okay, so I'm going to go back to your numbers. And they say 4 to 6 before meals. So I'm going to look at what the 6 is. 6 divided by 0.0555. equals 108 before meals. They're saying, okay, so they're saying 108, and they're saying 4. Let's see what 4 is. 4 divided by 0.0555 equals 72. So that's a huge range, 72 to 108 before meals. And they're saying, then again, after meals, 72 to, let's see what 8 is. 8 divided by 0.0555. It's 144. So they're saying you're normal if you go up to 144 after meals. And that's wrong. That's just downright wrong. Okay. So ideal levels before meals. Oh, that says normal. Ideal is 4 to 6 and up to 8 after. So it's the same basic thing. Yeah. So I don't agree with them. I think that, you know, if you're going to convert our like 110. So if I take 110, which is what I think it should be, the max after meal, 110 times 0.0555 equals 6.1. Right. So what they're saying 6 before meals. I'm saying the max should be 6.1 after meals. Okay. And then 85, which is what we like to be, or 70, you know, let's just say 80 times 0.0555 equals 4.4. Okay. Hope that helps. I'm going to go back to the Q&A. Okay. So now you have it. It's the 0.0555. If you're trying to convert from the international units to the American units, you go divide it by 0.0555. Okay. No more there. Raise your hand, star 2, if you have a question. Anybody? Okay, while I'm waiting for hands to raise, I'm going to go to the chat and see if there's other questions in here that Lynn hasn't answered. Okay. Lynn posted the ZRT Labs link. So Lynn asked, if there's not enough insulin to let glucose enter the cells, too much glucose remains in the blood, would this cause the need to urinate more frequently? Yeah, it absolutely would. And that's one of the symptoms of diabetes is urinating frequently, right? Get thirsty and you're urinating frequently because you're peeing out a lot of there, trying to pee out the extra urine. Darcy types in athletic greens. No, I've not looked at that one. Lynn put the links up for the superfoods, the one that I like from Health Force, that's mint, Ormus greens, the natural foods, kale powder. She put up everything. I don't know about this Athletic Greens. I've not heard of that one before. I'm going to look at it right now. Athletic Greens, where every ingredient adds nutrition to the formula. Let's see. Spirulina, less than apple powder. Inulin, I'm going to look at the sugars. Whoa. I wouldn't take this one. Oh, 45 milligrams, not grams. Shoot. I was like, 45 grams of sugar? That's a lot. No, but it's 45 milligrams of sugar. That's fine. Inulin, FOS, wheatgrass, alfalfa, barley leaf powder. I watch and make sure that this says it's gluten-free because you can have traces. Bilberry. So there's a bunch of different little fruit powders, but it only adds up to less than a gram of sugar, a lot less, so I'm not worried about that. Green tea, goji, kelp. It's got a lot of good things. Pea protein, bioflavonoids, artichoke, eleutherose. It's got some adaptogens, beta-glucans, astragalus, dairy-free probiotics. Yeah, it looks good. Oh, yeah, no compromises, no artificial, no gluten, no GMO, no peanuts. This looks awesome. Yeah, who posted that? That looks good. Athletic Greens. Yeah, but no, it doesn't have a higher amount of sugar, Lynn. It's 0.45 milligrams, right? It's not even a gram. I thought the same thing. So then there should be 4 to 6. The 4 to 6, the range for after meals should be like 6 up to 6.1. A 4 is kind of low for after meal, but it could be like between 5 and 6 after meal would probably be ideal. 4 is really weird to have it that low. That would be 70-something. Right? Darcy says it tastes good. Great. Thank you. Great. So that might be a good one for Brooks, not Brooks person, Grace's person. Yeah. Good. Thank you. I love sharing on these things because we get so many good ideas. Grace, why does the sugar go up and down from like 190 to 110, then back up to 140 when one is starting a program to reduce the sugar? You know, it depends. The body's getting used to it. I'd have to see the charts. So you guys are welcome to collect glucose charts from people and post them so I could take a look at them. So if it's got 190 and it's coming down to 110, it might be that when you give them the chromium or magnesium, that it's helping the sugar get into the cells and come down. It might be stress that causes it to go back up. So there's a lot of things and there's a lot of variations. What I typically find is within a week of really strict adherence to the lack of allergens plus the supplements plus the clean food and the keeping the sugars down, it goes down dramatically. So like I said before, if somebody's diabetic and their numbers are up already in the, you know, 140s, 180s, 200 range, you can't, like, say don't eat anything that raises it above 110 because they wouldn't eat anything, which could be good if they're willing to do a fast. But you want to not take anything that raises their sugar more than 20 points. So they take it before, and if it peaks at 20 points higher and then comes down, that's good. If it goes higher than that, you want to reduce that to help it restore insulin sensitivity. And, of course, whenever you're working with somebody who's been diagnosed with diabetes, who's been on a bunch of medication, and their sugars aren't coming down, you start to suspect either the pancreas is burned out or you start to suspect that they might have latent adult onset diabetes. Nancy has some green, let me look at those, some green capsules from Young Living. And that's capsules, so it would be easier for somebody when they're traveling to use capsules. Let's see. I'm going to look at that one and see what's in it. Now, years ago when I first started recommending greens powders, there was very little. There was greens first. There was the Premier Research ones, which just didn't taste so good and I had very bad compliance with. And there weren't a whole lot of others. And now, you know, everybody's on the bandwagon of making all these green powders, so there's competition for making them taste good and be good. So it's made with spirulina, alfalfa sprouts, barley grass, bee pollen, eleuthero, Pacific kelp and therapeutic grade essential oils. You have to take 4 capsules. It has what oils? Melissa, lemon, so it's lemon balm that's really relaxing, lemongrass relaxing, lemon, which is great for improving liver detoxification and gut, rosemary. So there's some good stuff in there. Yeah, that looks like a good one. I don't know if it doesn't say whether it's gluten-free or not, but that's always what's something that I look at. Did I answer the question about the cauliflower? I didn't see a question about cauliflower. Let me look back on chat. Was that on the chat? Well, Lynn, you're going to have to repost the thing about the cauliflower because I don't see a question about cauliflower. Oh, there you go. Kay had 2 in a row, and I thought I had already done it. Okay, Kay. I've been experimenting on myself and noticed when I eat cauliflower, particularly when it's raw, like steamed, I'm frequently nauseous, and I've actually vomited on occasion. Absolutely fine with the other cruciferous. Any idea why I am reacting to the cauliflower? Garlic also makes me itchy, and also all the acylin vegetables do not sit easily. So you may have some sulfur issues on why it's only the cauliflower and not the others. Hard to say. Food sensitivities are one of those things that it's really hard to get to, like, why a particular food. Sulfur is one of the things that are common between the garlic and the cauliflower. The cauliflower may be higher in sulfur than some of the other cruciferous, because I know that when you blend it up and eat it, if you don't cook it, it's got that harshness to it, that very strong flavor to it. So it could be the sulfur that's in both of them. It could be allicin. They don't sit well. I would say for now, just eliminate anything that doesn't sit well and don't eat it. And then retest it later after you've done some resetting. Okay. Let's see if anybody else has questions. Hands up, *2. Any questions, comments, cases? I love cases, so be sure to bring them to the calls. And you know that you have this call. And then at the beginning, let's see, we're in June. We also have another one. I don't know when the next ones are because we're doing Spring into Vitality, but we have the ones at the beginning of the month. Every first Thursday of the month, you have access to our open office hours calls. So use them. I think we gave you 6 months of access to that. So use them. And the more you put this stuff into practice, the more we want to hear from you and the more we want to, like, get into cases. You can upload people's glucose charts if you have questions about them. So I'm here to help you and to learn this stuff and also to help a lot of people. So I'll check one more time on the Q&A. What was the name of the last green powder you talked about that was in capsules? It's a Young Living, and I'll copy it into the chat. It's Young Living Multi Greens Capsules. Let's put it into the chat. Oh, Lynn already did. Of course Lynn already did. good. Good. Nothing? Nothing? Okay. This has been fun. I hope this was really helpful for you. Even if you didn't have questions of your own, it sometimes helps to just listen to other people's questions and their answers and my answers. And feel free to just keep your questions rolling. In between the calls, you can put them in the chat. You also have access to the Q&A that I'll read on the calls. And you also have access to the Facebook group. So feel free to do all of that. I'll open up your line so we can say goodbye. Thank you so much. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye. Bye. Bye-bye.